Bolivia's former president Evo Morales made a power grab, and it failed. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Morales tried to take the recent election, but even the military and police started to turn on him. This week, he stepped down. What's the future of Bolivia, and how will that impact Argentina, Venezuela, Honduras, and more? Also, a group of Palm Beach County employees claim that they were punished for not showing up to shelters during Hurricane Dorian. Can governments force non-essential workers to work during an emergency? Finally,
it took Arnold 6.5 seconds to fall 500 feet. During that time, an image of his son, Paris, flashed before his eyes.
Haitian-American author Edwige Danticat talks about facing our mortality in her latest collection of short stories. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's been another big shakeup in Latin American leadership. Last month, Bolivian President Evo Morales tried to hold his post for a fourth term through a power grab. But shortly after the votes were tallied, there were calls for more fair elections. An independent audit found there was manipulation of the computer systems used to tally those votes. Protests broke out, and even some in the military and police had turned on Morales. This weekend, he stepped down.
I am resigning, just so that my brothers and sisters and leaders of the movement toward socialism don't continue being harassed, persecuted, and threatened.
That audio, by the way, comes from NPR. Well, joining us now to discuss how all of this played out, but more importantly, what this means for governments across Latin America, WLRN's Americas correspondent Tim Padgett joins us. Tim, always great to have you.
Thank you, Luis.
And Florida International University Professor of Political Science, Eduardo Gamarra. Professor, thank you so much for being here. Professor, let me start with you. Help us understand the government of Bolivia and how it works, how it's been working the last 10 years. What is this? I mean, the system itself, and I know that's a lot to explain, but how would you describe what that is?
Well, Bolivia is a presidential multi-party system, and it has been really since independence. However, over the last 13 years now, when Evo Morales was first elected in 2005, he was sworn in 2006, he has been gradually moving Bolivia towards a single-party system, changing the constitution very early in his tenure, then reinterpreting his own constitution to enable himself to be reelected, such that he has been already president for three times. More importantly, as a result of his popularity, and it's important to understand that he was a popular leader, he claims to be the first indigenous president of Bolivia in a country that is about 60% indigenous.
Let's go back to, real quickly, presidents in Bolivia are allowed two terms.
They're allowed two terms, five-year terms.
Right. But he was going for his fourth.
Right.
How did he pull that off?
Well, this is probably one of the more controversial dimensions of it, because he controls Congress, two-thirds of Congress, he controls the electoral tribunal, he controls the courts, he controls the executive branch. He essentially has a monopoly over power. So in 2014, when he ran for a third re-election, a year later, sort of taking advantage of his popularity, he called for a referendum that, again, this is very early in his third term, that would have enabled him to indefinitely run for president, right? And so he calls for a referendum asking for a change in the Constitution, and Bolivians basically voted against it, 52 to about 48. And so the president didn't accept the results of that referendum, had himself basically the institutions that he controls, especially the equivalent of our Supreme Court, which interprets the Constitution, basically said that according to a San Jose Pact declaration, right, it was Evo Morales' human right to be reelected indefinitely. And so based on that, he became eligible to run for office this time.
For another time. All right. Tim, you interviewed him a couple of times early in his presidency back in the mid-2000s. How would you describe him? And going back to what the professor said, that he's so popular at the time, mm-hmm. what was it?
Well, as he pointed out, the fact that he was the first indigenous president in Bolivia, in a country that is majority indigenous. And that meant a lot, not just politically, but economically, because it gave him sort of political leverage to do things early in his presidency, like nationalize the natural gas industry, which is the most important natural resource they have there. And that meant a lot, especially to the indigenous community that felt that for centuries, whites and Europeans had come in and pillaged, Bolivia's natural resources to the detriment of the indigenous population. So that made him very popular. But early in his presidency, as you were noting, when I would interview him, he would always make this point that we outside of Bolivia didn't understand the kind of, quote, indigenous democracy that he was trying to develop there, that it was a democracy that was played by a sort of different set of rules, one that it was essentially a euphemism for Evo saying, I should be president in this system as long as I'm popular, as long as they love me. And that was one of the big reasons, I think, that he felt he was justified in, as Eduardo pointed out, pushing this unconstitutional pursuit of constant reelection, because he felt under the indigenous sort of communal, as he always called it, democracy of Bolivia, he should be there as long as he wanted to, as long as his indigenous supporters wanted him to be there.
Going back to this past election, who was running?
It was Evo Morales against a former president, actually, of Bolivia, Carlos Mesa, who represents the more conservative opposition in Bolivia. And I think you have to. It's ironic that Mesa himself had to step down some years back, or actually just before Morales became president.
In fact, Mesa has a rather checkered past, I would say. He was one of Bolivia's most outstanding journalists in the 80s and 90s, who then was drafted by another popular president, reformer, who grew up in the United States and spoke Spanish with an American accent, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who in fact was the sponsor of the major investment that occurred in exploration for natural gas in the 90s. Those discoveries, the irony of this is that the discovery of natural gas has really been at the core of the debates in Bolivia over the past 20 years. President Sanchez de Lozada wanted to send this natural gas to California through Chile, right? Evo Morales and his supporters mobilized in 2002 and eventually ousted him because we were going to, in theory, give our natural gas to our historical enemies. Chile defeated Bolivia in a war in 1879 and made Bolivia landlocked.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the background to it. When Carlos Mesa stepped in as vice president, he pardoned Evo Morales. President Sanchez de Lozada and his cabinet resigned, much like Evo Morales resigned today, mm-hmm. right, in the context of a popular insurrection. And President Sanchez de Lozada now lives in Maryland. He's been living there for the last 15 years.
And what was he running on? I mean, what was his, in running against, Morales? What was the campaign
well,
about?
It wasn't easy to run against Morales economically because for the past 13 years, particularly because the price of natural gas has been so high, just for example, the way it was so high in oil was so high in Venezuela during the heyday of the Chavista regime. It was hard to run against Evo Morales on an economic platform because people in Bolivia do feel like they're more prosperous than they've been in the past. What he was pointing out was, though, despite our prosperity, this man really is turning Bolivia into a dictatorship if he keeps running and winning, particularly by fraud, right, the way he was doing. And I think that resonated with just enough of the Bolivian population that when Evo did try to rig this election, it backfired him badly.
And remind us what happened. In late October, during that election, he was in the lead, or so he says he was in the lead,
right.
And then all of a sudden everything stopped.
We see this a lot in Latin American elections. If the trend, if the vote counting trend seems to go the way that the ruling party doesn't really seem to like, oh gosh, all of a sudden the computers go down.
But I pardon me for interrupting.
No.
But to me, you know, the the government of Evo Morales, in fact, structured the entire system, rigged the entire system, so that, for example, is what I call normative fraud, which is really everything from the Constitution to the laws are rigged in such a way that no matter what, the ruling party candidate was supposed to win. Now, given the context in Bolivia, given the fact that Evo was an unconstitutional candidate, right, what legitimized him was, in fact, the very presence of Carlos Mesa as a candidate, right? Carlos Mesa was Evo Morales' spokesperson until a year ago, right? Until a year ago, he was Bolivia's spokesperson in The Hague, where Bolivia sued Chile for the right to negotiate, you know, the right to return to the sea. And Carlos Mesa was that spokesperson. So you see how convoluted this is. So now, in the context of that normative fraud, they thought they were going to win because they essentially sponsored, right, four other candidates. A senator from Santa Cruz, Oscar Ortiz, probably the only legitimate candidate. Then out of the blue came a Korean, Chi, right, a fanatical right-wing candidate, anti-gay, anti-everything you can imagine, right? And out of the blue, he obtained 8% of the vote, right? So that there was no possible way for the opposition to muster enough strength to defeat Evo Morales at the polls. And then when that didn't work, it's exactly what Tim said. On the day of the elections, what did they do?
The system
they essentially rigged the system, right?
And I'm talking
about
Florida International University professor.
Well, we should explain, rig the system in a way that would give Evo Morales an outright victory in the first round so that he wouldn't have to go to a second round
because
against
he had
Mesa,
to win by,
which he would probably have lost.
He had to win 40%,
right?
But with a 10-point difference
over the next guy.
Over the second
placement. Again, I'm talking with Florida International University professor, political science, Eduardo Gamarra, and America's correspondent here, WLRN, Tim Padgett, discussing the resignation of President Evo Morales in Bolivia. Again, you can follow more of the Bolivia story at WLRN.org. Okay, so then that happens, Tim, and then all of a sudden there are protests. But it's not just that there are protests, it's the fact that some in the police, the military, some of the people that Morales thought he'd have help him turned on him.
Yeah, that was the surprising part, at least to those of us outside of Bolivia, because I guess we're so used to, in the past year or so, watching the situation in Venezuela and seeing how rock hard the security forces' support of President Nicolas Maduro in that country is, for example. So I think we were all taken a little bit by surprise by how the police first, because they actually started joining the protests, and then the military high command went to Morales and said, this is no longer tenable, the game's up, you've got to step down. Now, that's where we get into this debate over whether then there was a coup in Bolivia, which
he
claims a coup. And look, if this were a more perfect world, what I would have liked to see the military do in Bolivia would have been to force Morales to do something even worse for him, which was to have stayed in office and then have to wait for a new election, which would not have included him. And then he would have had to peacefully transfer power democratically to a new president. And then he wouldn't be able to claim that he's a martyr who's the victim of a coup.
I would just add a couple of elements to Tim's explanation. First, Evo kind of set his own trap, right? When he reinitiated the count after 23 hours of shutting it down, right? And essentially moving very quickly to certify that he had won by 10.57% over Carlos Mesa, right? He then believed that he could mobilize the masses, his party's masses, in support of his victory. What he didn't anticipate were a couple of things. Number one, that there would be such a turnout, particularly of young people. It's amazing what the movement was in Bolivia. And Tim knows this because he's been looking at Latin America for so long. University students in Latin America are historically on the left, and they're historically not pro, let's call it, you know, capitalist or right-wing solutions. Yet every one of the public universities across Bolivia, including El Alto, right, mobilized against Evo Morales. That was the key. The second key was the development of a national civic movement. These are essentially chambers of commerce that all of a sudden also put forth a new leadership, a leadership by this young man, Camacho, who has now become sort of the figure behind the opposition's movement.
What happens now? I mean, what's going on right now, and where power vacuum, how is it filled?
Evo resigned, and essentially what he did is he created a power vacuum by taking with him the vice president, the president of the Senate, and the president of the Chamber of Deputies. That means that now, according to the Constitution, the second vice president of the Senate is supposed to assume office. To assume office, however, Congress has to assemble. Congress is dominated by Evo Morales' party, the MAS, and they will have to vote by two-thirds to elect this woman named Jeanine Añez, a senator from the Northern Department of Beni. This afternoon, it looks like there will not be a quorum. In the meantime, Evo Morales landed in Mexico and gave this rallying speech, basically, to his mass.
Is he seeking asylum in Mexico?
Yes, he's
obtained it.
He's been granted it. Yeah.
What happens in Bolivia? How does that play out with what we see in Ecuador, Peru, Venezuela, Brazil, throughout Latin America? Does it have a ripple effect, or are they in a silo?
Well, the good news is what Eduardo, I think, so aptly points out is that you would expect students, for example, to be, you know, more sympathetic to left-wing governments in Latin America, but that's not the case because so many millennials in Latin America have seen how catastrophic so many of these left-wing regimes have turned out. In Venezuela, for example, the youth vote there is very much against the socialist regime. In Nicaragua, the university students are very much against left-wing President Daniel Ortega. So that's the good news. I think you do have a mass of young, politically active voters in these countries that could, you know, look at what happened in Bolivia and say, you know what, we could make that same kind of push here. The bad news is reality, which is that Venezuela is not Bolivia. The Venezuelan regime has a much, much more brutal grip on power than even Evo had in Bolivia. So we really shouldn't be jumping to the conclusion that we're going to see a domino effect here.
Right.
Professor Gamarro, I'll give you the last word. Where do you see Bolivia going from here?
Hopefully, to be optimistic, I hope that we have a new round of elections and that Bolivia is able to introduce new political actors that are younger, that are committed to liberal democratic values, and that in some measure can move away from this, from these 14 years of authoritarianism. At the same time, I'm realistic. I think it's going to be very difficult because if Congress does not vote in a new president, not only do they need a new president, they need to convoke new elections. Under the electoral law, it's going to be 150 days before we can have elections. And they have to elect a new tribunal because the electoral tribunal is the one that currently is in jail for committing the fraud.
He is Florida International University Professor of Political Science Eduardo Guerrera, and also we heard from WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
Still to come, can the county make its employees work during a hurricane? We're going to look at a story out of Palm Beach County about workers who said, no, we won't, and the county punished them. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Back in August, Category 5 Hurricane Dorian was inching its way towards South Florida. We were unsure for some time if it would hit us. For thousands of workers in Palm Beach County, it meant they might have to show up to a shelter to work. The county mandates that all county employees be prepared to work in an evacuation center during hurricanes. It's a policy that was started after Hurricane Irma. 28 employees didn't report for work at the shelters. They were suspended for a week without pay and put on notice. If it happens again, you could lose your job. The Sun Sentinel's Brooke Badinger spoke with several county employees concerned about the work requirement in the shelters, and she joins us now. Brooke, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, we should note that we've reached out to the county for a statement about this story. We are still waiting for a response from administrators. Okay, so Brooke, as Hurricane Dorian was approaching Florida, what did Palm Beach County officials say to their employees about what was expected of them?
They were expected to, you know, report to work if they had an assignment, whether it was to work in the shelters or at a point of distribution, passing out supplies, or in the county's emergency operations center.
Do we know how many workers were called to shelters who were expected to show up?
I think about 300. The county opened 11 shelters for Hurricane Dorian, and there's usually about 30 people working in those shelters.
And how were they notified?
They were notified with phone calls. Employees told me in a couple of cases there were, you know, many phone calls if they didn't answer. And I believe they also received activation emails, which is the same, you know, process during Hurricane Irma.
So what does the county say about what's expected from its employees during a hurricane? What do they ask of their employees?
They ask them, you know, to show up for their assignments and to be, you know, prepared to work during a hurricane, basically.
Because, I mean, one of the things that jumps out at me here is the fact that, you know, of the 28 people who didn't show up during Hurricane Dorian and were punished, half were librarians. So,
right.
Librarians? Are they, you know, people like Park Service? Are these people expected to be ready to deal with all the things that happen in a hurricane?
Yes, and that was a huge concern from a lot of employees who felt that they, you know, weren't equipped to deal with some of the situations that might arise. And that was also a big issue during Hurricane Irma when a lot of them, had to work then too. The only difference is then they weren't going to face any discipline if they didn't show up, because that was the county's first run through with this new policy.
I want to get a sense of the nature of what they're expected to do at these shelters. I mean, can they handle medical emergencies? Can they handle, because it, once you're in the storm, you know, nobody's, you can't call anybody. Nobody's coming.
Right. Yeah. The county does contract out to, for additional medical staff in the shelters, and they have law enforcement officers who are also assigned to work in some of the shelters. But the employees are expected to, you know, be visible in the shelters to answer questions that the public might have and sign them in and direct them to where they're going to be sleeping. But a lot of employees told me that that's not realistic. Like there ends up being a lot of more situations where they have to kind of use their judgment to handle some of these things. And those aren't, you know, the only things that they end up having to do.
So what happened to these 28 employees that decided that they're not going to show up?
Yeah, they were suspended for 1 week without pay, and now they have that, you know, on their record saying that they were disciplined, and if it happens again, you know, they are threatened that they might be terminated.
But don't they have exemptions?
Yes. If you're sick or injured, or if you're caring for an ill family member or something like that, you can get excused, but you have to apply for that beforehand. And in some cases, employees were telling me that there just wasn't enough time. Like for example, the employee who found out a week before Hurricane Dorian, that she was pregnant, and she wasn't willing to, you know, work in a shelter. She didn't show up, and then she was suspended.
Again, I'm talking with Sun Sentinel's Brooke Badinger. 28 employees in Palm Beach County were suspended for 1 week without pay for not reporting for assignments at evacuation centers during Hurricane Dorian. Some county employees have expressed concerns for their jobs if they don't report during storms. You can find more on this story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And again, to note, we've reached out to the county for a statement about this story. We are still waiting to hear from them. Brooke, you were able to read through some of the questions that county employees had about their safety during the storm, because the county was asking its employees about questions or comments that they have about what's expected of them. This is one of the questions that was posted. Quote, if a Hurricane 5 is coming and staff have been mandatory volunteered to work at the shelters, if disaster happens and we all die, is the county prepared to handle the lawsuits? What extent of liability is Palm Beach County responsible for in the event of employee losses due to shelter coverage? End quote. So, Brooke, how did the county respond to those questions, especially that one?
Yeah, the county for that one said that, you know, the buildings that are used as shelters are safe, and encouraged employees to contact the risk management department for, you know, what the county is liable for, basically. And that was the case with some of the other questions, too. You know, the county directed employees to check with other departments or ask those questions during on-site training, which, you know, every employee was supposed to have at some point, but not all of them did.
Let's go back to Hurricane Irma, because that's kind of what led us to where we are today. What happened during Irma? What was the situation?
Yeah, apparently there was some situation where the Red Cross apparently told the county that they wouldn't be able to staff all of the shelters. They had, you know, cut back services in all three counties, or in most counties, because they were
all
drawn.
All three, you're talking about Miami-Dade, Broward, yes, and Palm Beach counties. Okay.
Right. Yeah. They were drawing themselves too thin. Their, you know, employees told me that they thought there was some kind of a situation where there was an argument about two additional shelters during, I think, Hurricane Matthew back in 2016, that the Red Cross apparently said that they wouldn't be able to staff. And so that's where some of this stems from.
And so the main concerns raised by the county employees, was it about how these shelters were run? You know, if they didn't have Red Cross there, you know, the sort of not just training, but also supplies, or one of the things you pointed out, radios, just the ability to communicate.
Right. Yeah, that was a huge problem during Hurricane Irma. A lot of the employees didn't have enough radios to be able to call for help, like across the school campuses where the shelters are set up. So if they needed help, they would have to physically run to locate like an officer or someone who could, you know, provide medical assistance. And then just beyond that, various safety concerns, you know, feeling they were ill-equipped to handle some of the situations that would arise. Particularly, there were female employees who said that they were directed to work in areas primarily populated with men. So those were the main concerns.
And from Irma to Dorian, were a lot of these things fixed, the issue with communication, training, all that stuff, or was it still the same problem?
I've been told that there wasn't, you know, they have radios now. They have enough radios. But as far as training goes, employees were telling me that they didn't feel that they still didn't feel that they had, you know, adequate training to handle this sort of stuff during Hurricane Dorian.
Well, we're still waiting, obviously, for Palm Beach County officials to respond to our call. But have you spoken to them? Have they said anything to you?
They haven't. I mean, I spoke with the Emergency Management Division, the senior manager there, just about some of these operations. But the county itself hasn't, you know, reached out or given a response to my questions.
And of the employees that you spoke with, and of course, they were worried about, you know, getting in trouble. So many of them spoke, you know, without identifying themselves. But what have they said about what's next? What else? Can they do anything?
Yeah, some are seeking legal, you know, representation, legal consultation outside of the county. Others are grieving their suspensions with the county's HR department, which I'm told is, you know, a whole process. But they hope that they'll be able to get their money back for that week of their suspension and get, like, the bad mark removed from their record.
Now, again, because the county hasn't responded directly to you about this story, but do we know if the county is updating any of its plans for future hurricane seasons?
Yeah, there's a plan that they, you know, hope to implement, like a rotation plan. So that would be a rotation of employees who would be assigned to shelters. My understanding is it would be 1 year, and then the next year they would be assigned to a different role, whether it's like a point of distribution or working in the emergency operations center. But it's tricky to get enough employees and enough employees trained for that, and the details are still kind of fuzzy about whether they'll be able to actually implement that next year.
We've been talking with the Sun Sentinel's Brooke Badinger. You can read her full story at our social media, WLRN Sundial. Brooke, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, we're going to reflect on our mortality in a powerful new collection of short stories from Haitian-American author Edwige Danticat. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. A man sees his life flash before his eyes as he falls from the sky. There's a list of thoughts that goes through his mind: love, loss, and regret, and an image of his son. This is a scene from Everything Inside, a new collection of short stories by Haitian-American novelist Edwige Danticat. Death and how people come to terms with it is a central theme of her latest book. Most of the short stories take place in locales like Miami and Haiti.
In this book, this collection is the first time that I feel that I have written about a place where I actually live.
Danticat was born in Haiti, lived in New York, now lives in Miami. She's been here since the early 2000s. She joined Sundial last week, and we talked about her book, The Haitian Immigrant Experience, and how she views mortality. In this book, the two themes that jump out at me a lot are death and this love-hate relationship people have with their home country, in this case, Haiti. Why are you so drawn to these topics? Because I see these over and over in your stories.
Death, I feel like, even as a young person, was something that sort of haunted me and fascinated me as a subject. Because in many ways, it's an unsolvable subject. And I even tried, you know, a little bit to solve it in this book that I would call The Art of Death, Writing the Final Story, which deals with how writers write about death.
But your 2017 book.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of the appeal maybe to me is the unknowable, but also I grew up in a house in Haiti where my uncle was a minister, and our weekends would be often a funeral Saturday morning, a wedding in the afternoon, and the church service on Sunday. So I got to experience that whole cycle of life, and it wasn't unusual for me as a young woman, you know, to be sitting there like with the minister's family looking at a coffin. So death and sort of what happens after has always been fascinating to me.
I'm wondering, how do you view your own mortality?
Well, I have, you know, I'm 50 now, which is a nice round age, and I've started writing in a public way, like publishing at 25, which was also another round age. So you sort of have these anniversaries, and again, watching when your parents have passed on, you feel like I felt like that sort of they were between me and, you know, whatever the next step was. But since they've passed on, you feel like, oh, it's just me and whatever the ceiling is. So I'm quite aware of my mortality, maybe too much for some of my friends and even for this conversation.
How is this book connected, though, too? Because I kept thinking about The Art of Death, and I kept thinking, there's a connection here. What is that connection?
Well, you know, in short stories, and I'm so glad, I understand this is one of the first short story books you've done on this book club. And I think in a way, short stories are perfect for book clubs, right? Because you can pick one up, you read it, and then you sort of mull that over and you go to the next one. But the task for the writer is to curate a collection, right? How do they fit together? And for me, they were joined by several things. Like I wanted to have an even number of stories, like eight, so that you have four kinds and then four of another type. But what joined them for me was certainly this a theme of love, love of family, love of country, and complicated love, certainly, but love, and certain rituals that is carried through death and grief. And how do we mourn away from the homes that we knew, away from the places where we were shaped. How do we love? How do we mourn? How do we raise our children? How do we do all that without the guidance of the elders?
When did you start writing these stories?
The earliest one is 2006. I moved here in 2002. So they span a really broad, you know, almost over a decade. But I kept returning back to them, and some of them had been published in different forums, but I kept going back to them, and I'm sort of that kind of writer. Like, if I have an opportunity to tweak and start over with a story, that I just have taken it until the very last possible point of no return in the publication cycle.
Let's look at a couple of these stories. We'll start with the first one, the story of Elsie. Mm-hmm. She's a caretaker, and one day she gets a call from her ex-husband. He's distraught. He tells her that his lover had been kidnapped in Haiti and they were demanding money. What were you trying to explore with the story about Elsie?
Elsie is a young woman who is a caretaker, as you mentioned, and it's a job that I think a lot of immigrant women take on. You know, when people come here, it's one of these somewhat quick entry jobs where you might go to a school and learn how to care for people, older people, sick people. And she's one that sometimes you see in the mall accompanying an older person throughout their day, sometimes in a uniform. And I wanted to explore sort of this complicated internal life that she had, these dreams that she had had with a man that she loved that then got sidetracked, and then this friendship that she had embraced that turns on her, and also that sort of a really sensitive dynamic, and I think in many communities where this relationship of, you know, for example, remittances, you know, for every diaspora community keeps a lot. It's a big part of the budget of the home community. But there's also this sort of pull and tug where people are sometimes, am I being like bamboozled? Like, does that person really need that money for school? Or is they, and that sort of strange relationship where this and this, without giving too much away, you know, plays out where someone calls with an urgent need. And then Elsie is in this position, like, how do I respond? And she responds in a way that is humane, you know, that is really beyond expectations, given the complicated relationship that this, you know, her husband had left her for this woman that he said was kidnapped. And then he has a rather bit of a twist.
Yes, definitely. Well, what is the profession of the caretaker? Tell us about her empathy and trust of other people.
Well, she, you know, she says it herself in the story that, you know, especially when other parts of her, you know, her humanity is tested, where she's like, I'm meant to care for people. And I think, you know, I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell do a talk about his book, Talking to Strangers, where he talks about something called the truth default. I think most of us want to trust people, you know, like we want to believe that people are always telling us the truth, and even in this job she's trained to care for other people, and that's the also like that duality of the immigrant. That's something that happened in my own life, where we have women, men too, but women who leave their children sometimes in other countries, you know, in their homeland, while they're here taking care of the children of other people, or they leave their elder parents and they're taking care of older people here. And they're doing that so that they can send money back home, so that, you know, so that their elders and their children can be taken care of. So it's a really strong part of the immigrant experience.
I'm speaking with Haitian American author Edwige Dantakot. She's the author of several books like Breath, Eyes, Memory, The Art of Death, and many others. Her newest book, Everything Inside, is this month's Sundial Book Club. It's a short story collection that explores how people come to terms with their own death and that of their loved ones. Let's get to the other topic you were talking about a minute ago. And it's, I don't know if you call it patriotism, but it's the struggle that people have immigrants have with their home country. And, you know, some people desperately want to go home, and other people, the thought of it is such a turnoff. They don't want to step foot back on it. Tell me what that relationship is with Haitian Americans in Haiti.
There is something about Haiti that is very hard to explain, like how much how deep that love goes. And I think in part it's because it's always been sort of underestimated under from the beginning, from the creation of the nation. So we as Haitians feel that pride that we accomplished this great, that our nation was birthed out of this impossible revolution, yet we did it. And for the, you know, centuries that followed now, you know, it's always been struggle, but there's been this hope that, you know, it's almost like if you have, you know, it's like, we're the underdog, and we sort of love, we want to embrace our country, we want to lift it up. So that's there's that a lot of the characters have that, because Haiti, no matter what's happening for them here, is always in the back of their mind. They always have someone there, but at the same time they're like, well, why can't it be better? You know, there's that pull and tug.
You know, it's always interesting in conversations with Haitians, depending on their age. You know, obviously the stories of Papa Doc and Baby Doc come up. Different generations have a different take on that, mm-hmm, though. Mm-hmm. But I mean, even after all these years, it's still there. That I don't think it'll ever go away.
Yeah, I can't quite explain it. I think in part, it's parents who, for a lot of, and even in the homes, there's that duality of like the parents who are like, you come from a great people, the Haitian Revolution, first Black Republic, and then the young people would say, well, I want to go see it, and the parents are like, not now, you know, maybe next year, you know. And so there's that whole like so young people who, so you have the idealization, especially in this, in Miami, it's like one of the places I've seen it most, with like the wearing of the flag, doing you know, in May, doing Haitian Heritage Month and all the different celebrations, and young people who've never been to Haiti but will talk about it with so much love. So it is generational. I think the you know, the closer you get to this period, the more, you know, some younger people, they have a kind of idealization about it, and they're this approach to kind of like, you know, the beaches, we want to see the positives, we don't want to talk about the negatives and such.
Well, you talk about the negatives, I mean, think about what's happening now. I mean, you have these protests with the current president, and I'm wondering what you're thinking when you see that, you see all this happening, because it's interesting, you just said, you know, it's like, not now, not yet, mm-hmm. But I mean, you see all this happening, what's going through your mind?
When you talk to young people, and I was there, and I was in Haiti last year when at the early onset of the protest, and you would, when you go through, you know, of course it wasn't as intense as it is now, and you try to go through the barricades, you might have a conversation with a young men, and there were mostly young men at the barricades there, and they will tell you they want change, you know, they want they want a society that can give them a future, that allows for their children to have a future. They want an end to the corrupt leadership and sort of the endless misery that a lot of them have to go through. And so it's about, you know, a stop to the continuation of just how things have always been. And I think you have also a new generation there that is looking at what's happening in other parts of the world, right, where people are protesting, where they're out, and there's a sense that they're part of a larger movement toward change, where people who have been oppressed, who have been economically, you know, displaced, are asking for a place at the table.
Let's get back to the book. I want to get back to this theme of death, mm-hmm. and to one of the stories, and you're going to read a portion for us. This is the story Without Inspection. What I found so fascinating is because you tackle death from the point of view of a person about to die. And I'm going to let you just go ahead and give us this reading first before we jump back in, but I'll just move aside and let you go ahead.
It took Arnold 6.5 seconds to fall 500 feet. During that time, an image of his son, Paris, flashed before his eyes. Paris, dressed in his red school uniform shirt and khakis the day of his kindergarten graduation. That morning, Paris's mother, Darlene, had skipped around the apartment, changing dresses, as if she were the one graduating, closing his eyes tightly as the hot wind he was plunging through battered his face. Arnold saw Paris at the classroom ceremony. He saw himself, too, standing next to Darlene, who had finally chosen a billowing sapphire-colored satin dress. He was in the one black suit he wore to everything, to weddings and to funerals. One reason not to own too many things was their crammed two-bedroom apartment, but the other, at least for him, had to do with never wanting to feel bound. To be attached to a few people was fine, to Paris and to Darlene, who were as much a part of him as his blood was, but he never wanted to be tied to things, to clothes and shoes, gathering dust and packed closets, to a fancy car that required hefty payments every month. No, it was simpler to be free as this fall, which he had neither intended nor chosen, this dive that had resulted from his left foot slipping off the scaffold and his body sliding out of his either loosened or broken safety harness, as though a wrathful hand had pulled the straps off him, tipped him on his side, and tossed him into the air. Then his body, attempting to regain some control, had corrected the angle at which he had begun falling, so that he was now plummeting headfirst toward the ground, which was not yet concrete, but dirt and soil, from which weeds, bushes, and flowers had been plucked to make way for a 48-story hotel. He was still falling, faster by the second. The wind felt increasingly resistant, each gust a hard blue veil to pierce through, even as the ground rose to meet him. His body veered farther left, and directly below him was an open cement mixer chute attached to a truck, the kind that had always looked like a spaceship to him.
I love this story because it's the point of view of a person facing their mortality in the final seconds. Where did the inspiration for that story come from?
When I first moved from New York here to Miami, there are two things that were regularly happening that I took notice of. And one was boatloads of people who were landing on Key Biscayne and other places. And then the second one was the people who were, every now and then, a person would be said to have fallen from a construction site. And there was a horrible case of one man who fell in like a quick cement even, and you would watch it on the news and it was the same. And then there was a statement from the construction company about investigations and so forth. And those things kind of gelled in my mind as a kind of first impression of like of now being a resident of this place. And so I had written a story about people coming from Haiti by boat and Krikrak called Children of the Sea. And it occurred to me at that time that suddenly there were updates to how this migration was happening. And now sometimes it was through the Bahamas, then it was speedboats, and people were told when they got within, you know, view of the beach to swim. And a lot of people couldn't swim, and there were some drownings resulting of that. So I want to tell the story from a point of view of a man who had gone through both of those things. And he tells the story as he's, you know, the story is written from his perspective as he's falling. And obviously the story is meant to be compressed and, you know, those seconds that he's falling, it is not. But what I also wanted to explore was that it's something that I personally experienced. It is that moment where someone is said to be dead, and then, well, the world doesn't know it yet, right? And I'd experienced that with my mother, where after she took her last breath, and then I had to tell the people outside that room with us. And then I had to call my brothers in New York to tell them. And then I remember lingering in that moment. And it's something I explore also in another story in the book called In the Old Days. And I remember just cherishing that moment where it's just like, well, maybe, you know, in that silence of that gap, that she's not yet gone, you know, because I haven't told everyone yet. And then I wondered, like, what is happening in this moment? Is she traveling? And what is happening to the body? What is happening to the mind? And where is she going? That's the premise, really, of that story of, like, of someone, what happens in that sort of gap between life and death.
Edwige Dantakad, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
That was Haitian-American author Edwige Dantakad. Her newest book, Everything Inside, is this month's Sundial Book Club. And that's Sundial for this Tuesday, November 12th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka. Our technical supervisor, Peter J. Meritz. A note to our listeners about today's program. We had a scheduled interview with the director and CEO of Miami International Airport today, Lester Sola. He unfortunately needed to cancel for personal reasons. We're working to reschedule that conversation. Now, coming up tomorrow, we will bring you live special coverage from NPR of the impeachment briefings from Washington, D.C. It starts at 10 a.m. Ambassador William Taylor, the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent are set to testify. At 8 p.m., we're going to bring you NPR's one-hour recap of the impeachment hearings. You can always find the latest impeachment news coverage at WLRN.org. And by the way, again, as I mentioned, don't forget our Sundial Book Club. Go to Facebook, look up Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. Again, we're reading Edwidge Dontacott for November. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or at WLRN.org. Always let us know what you think of the program. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Yeah.